Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today in the program, we're talking about where religion and spirituality cross paths. We'll be joined soon by Rick Ernst of the Park City Community Church.
And then a philosophical conundrum, the trolley problem, or would you throw the fat guy off the bridge? This is a conversation with the New York Times bestselling author Thomas Cathcart about what determines our ethical decisions.
And then we'll speak about one of the most essential components to life, or probably the most essential component, that's water. We'll be joined by Zach Frankel. He's the executive director of the Utah Rivers Council, and we'll talk about what real water conservation means. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, leading a spiritual life may not necessarily include religion, and a religious life may not necessarily include spiritual endeavors. But of course, the two aren't mutually exclusive, and as both practices evolve, many churches are including specific spiritual practice that may not quote scripture, but at the same time revolve around those principles. One of those churches in the Park City community is the Park City Community Church. And here to tell us about a new program called Fully Awake and Truly Alive, Spiritual Practices to Nurture Your Soul. It all fits into the bigger picture of life. And joining us is Rick Ernst, a member at the Park City Community Church. And good morning to you, Rick.
Thank you, Lynn.
Well, you were telling me before we came on about how you recently moved to the Park City area and you were looking for a community. And I think this is what a lot of people do when they look towards a church. They're looking for not necessarily, prayer and things that revolve around quoting scripture, for example, but they're looking for a community. And you found that, but you wanted to evolve it a little bit further.
My history is in Protestant churches, and Joan, my wife, and I moved here a little over a year ago, and we wanted to find a community. We wanted to find friends. We wanted to find connection, and we attended the Park City Community Church, and we liked some of the people there. We made some friends, and we decided to get more involved. And the Park City Community Church is really, really amazing in its outreach. Right now, on Thursday, we're making sandwiches for the Salvation Army. We are very involved with Family Promise in Salt Lake to help those who are homeless. We just started our own coat drive. It's going to get cold pretty soon around here. And so we have a tremendous outreach. We also support Crossroads Urban Center and, of course, the Christian Center here in Park City. Our youth are really active also. They just got back from a trip in June where they helped the victims of Hurricane Sandy in Staten Island, New York. So what we are trying to do is we're endeavoring to change lives so that we can change the world. And that's really the essence of what's going on at our church.
And so really, Rick, going outside of yourself are these things that you're mentioning, which nurtures the soul. But the program you've created is about sort of going inside and nurturing your soul that way.
Yes, I think that the first step is nurturing your soul. And I'm leading a study called Fully Awake, Truly Alive. And it focuses on spiritual practices that nurture your soul. For instance, the first one is the practice of caring for your body, finding new images, deep wisdom, and blessings.
That sounds wonderful. And it's a whole week that you practice this?
Yes.
Each chapter?
Yes. Each chapter, it's over a 9-week period. This is the first one. And the first several are introspective. and then we get to community, and then we get to service. So there's a progression there of the practice of taking care of your body, the practice of rest, restoring your energy, your creativity, your spirit, the practice of silence, finding spaciousness, stillness, and inner peace.
Rick, I see you have a book here, and is this the program?
Yes, yes. This is the book I'm following. It's each chapter focuses on one of these spiritual practices.
Now, I notice, sorry to interrupt, but I notice it is written by Reverend Jane Vinar.
That's right.
So it is, it does encompass, or does it, some prayer and specific, I don't know, scripture or Bible passage?
She finds wisdom in a lot of spiritual traditions, not only Christianity. And one of the ones that I encourage people to do, which we end up most of our sessions, is silent meditation. We're in a real noisy, noisy world. And it's basically be still and know that I am God.
Now, Rick, how did you find this program?
I wanted to create a program for people to better be a part of a community.
And did you bring it from your previous community
No, I found it.
I found it here.
Yeah, I found it. I found it on the internet.
And who is who's the target audience for this particular book and program? I'm going to couple the two, book and program, because it sounds like the book is promoting a program.
I think this is a perfect book for Park City, Utah. I see it all over the place.
and why is that? Why do you think Park City, Utah so much?
Because I feel that a lot of people who I've met here are turned off by organized religion. They find spirituality by walking their dogs.
They may not be atheists, but they might be agnostic.
Right.
So they don't want to have a practiced organized religion, but they consider themselves spiritual. But that's always kind of a vague
notion.
That's right.
Yeah. What is that? You know, right. How do you define that? Yes. So a very important part of spirituality for me is being part of a community. Because I fall off the bandwagon. I say these things and I practice these things, but I can easily be led astray. I mean, I can easily be. So I need a community to bring me back. And that's the strength of what we do.
And is the Park City Community Church community the type that you're describing here, more spiritual in essence than looking for an organized religion to adhere to?
It's a wonderful, wonderful outreach. And all of the charities and the causes that I've mentioned are a part of that. But I feel it starts with a personal transformation in how I see the world. And that's what we're trying to do, is to help people take care of their bodies, you know.
And how has that affected you? I mean, since you came upon this Fully Awake and Truly Alive program and book, have you had a transformation in yourself?
Yes, because the transition that's happened for me is that I am more aware, more able to listen to what you have to say rather than me trying to give you a prescription for what I think you should do. And I always jump to that conclusion. I always jump to, I know what the answer is. Now, I'm just waiting for you to stop talking so I can give you mine. And it's hard. It's a discipline. All of these things that I listed here are disciplines. They're not always easy for us. It's not always easy for me to be silent. I'm an extrovert. I like to talk. But I find a lot of peace and satisfaction and spirituality in being quiet.
Mm. And when you talk, you can't listen. A wise man said that to me the other day. That's right. Before we go on, so you mentioned the first 4 weeks, I believe, and I want you to tell us about the last five. But first, I want to ask you, Rick, about you were telling me this story about how the church had a room to remodel.
Yes. I'm a retired financial advisor, and I ended up on the finance committee. I don't know why that always happens, but it always happens. And the church wanted to remodel one of the offices, and it was right by the sanctuary. And we have a beautiful sanctuary. If you haven't been in our sanctuary, please do it, because there's windows on three sides. It's all open, natural light. And they wanted to have something smaller for baptisms, for small groups, for prayer, and so on. And they decided to they wanted to call it a chapel. And I just glaze over when you say chapel. I said, why don't we expand the idea to be a spiritual life center and not make it just about a room? And so pretty soon we are going to start remodeling that office so that small groups can meet. I hope to start a silent meditation group. The prohibitive factor in starting a silent meditation group is there's always people running around the church. It's always noisy. and it's important to have silence. And so that's where we're aiming. And so it's more than just remodeling a room. It's basically starting a spiritual life center. For instance, on October 7th, we are going to start Tai Chi at 10 a.m. And we are going to introduce a labyrinth this Saturday and Sunday. Excuse me.
Where is that? Is the labyrinth at the church?
At the church, okay. In the fellowship hall.
Okay.
And by walking the labyrinth, you'll be able to create a sacred space as well as a place that takes you away from your ego and allows focus for what you are seeking. It might be just naming a sorrow, a feeling, a desire to help others, but it's a silent time. We are going to have the labyrinth available every first Sunday of the month at 8 a.m. before our services. So it's a contemplative. I led a hike this summer at McPolin Farm on the nature trail. We got out there at 7:30 a.m. Park City doesn't get up very early on Sunday. And we had the whole place to ourselves. It was magical.
And spiritual and religious.
Yeah, that's right.
I wanted to ask you quickly, with just a minute left, how are those members of the church that are into, Bible study and the Sunday morning thing and singing the hymns?
More traditional.
Right. How are
We offer that also, Lynn.
And, yes.
We offer a Bible study, several Bible studies during the week. One that we're starting, that just started last week, it's called The Meaning of Jesus, Two Visions by Marcus Borg and N.T. Wright. The book is a comparison or a contrast study of two approaches to the study of Jesus and the New Testament. The reader is left to decide where to stand on the issues. So it's a way of looking at ancient texts which provide wisdom for me today. They aren't always exactly historically true, but they provide wisdom. And that's what we're focusing on.
Great. Well, Rick Ernst, thanks for joining us today. Quickly, can you just run through the last five? I think we stopped at the practice of letting go.
Yes. The practice of community is discovering support, encouragement, and interdependence. The practice of hospitality is inviting, welcoming, and nurturing the stranger. And the practice of service is cultivating generosity, kindness, and joy. And the last one is the fruits of practice, how to live gratefully, humbly, and compassionately.
The program is called Fully Awake and Truly Alive, Spiritual Practices to Nurture Your Soul. And Rick, how can people find out more about this?
They can email me at 88rickernst@gmail.com. My phone number is 435-214-7678.
Okay, Rick, thanks for stopping by today. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with that philosophical conundrum of should we throw the fat guy off the bridge or the trolley problem with Thomas
Cathcart.
Thank you, Cathcart.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is the only in-town private country club just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch in Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from checking and savings accounts to business lending. We have Heber Valley Bank in Midway and Heber, and Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Can't get my own name right. Well, our next guest takes on the question that has inspired decades of lively discussion. It's an ethical conundrum, and you don't have to be well-versed in philosophy to address it. It's called the trolley problem, and our guest, Harvard-educated Thomas Cathcart, is a New York Times best-selling author and has now written a new book. It's called The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? And he's joining us now to explain that very curious title. And welcome Thomas Cathcart to The Mountain Life. Are you there, Thomas? Welcome to The Mountain Life, Thomas Cathcart.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Glad to be here.
Maybe you should set up, because you're the storyteller here, the ethical conundrum that out of which has sprung this crazy branch of philosophy, or I shouldn't even say crazy, just a branch of philosophy called trolleyology.
Yeah, maybe a little crazy. Yeah, well, the trolley problem actually goes back to 1967 when a British philosopher named Philippa Foote first posed it in an article. And nobody except a few philosophy nerds had ever heard of it until very recently. And then suddenly it went viral on YouTube in a lecture by a professor at Harvard. 4.4 million people have now watched this lecture, probably more people than have heard lectures in person at Harvard in the last 50 years. So, and the original trolley problem goes like this. Well, this is a little bit of a variation on the original, but here's the variation. The trolley is careening out of control. It's coming down the track at a fast rate of speed. It's clearly, there's nobody in charge, obviously. You're standing beside the track. You see this crazy trolley coming, and you think, what in the world can I do? And you notice that there are five people on the track, and that if you do nothing, the trolley's going to plow into the five people and kill them all. But you also notice that you're standing next to a switch. And if you throw that switch, you see that it will divert the trolley onto a siding. Unfortunately, on the siding, there's one man standing there. So the question is, would you pull the switch? Most people reply, well, yeah, they would. You know, it's better that one die than that five die. Mm-hmm. And if you do nothing, five are going to die. Okay, next scenario. Now you're up on a footbridge over the track, and the trolley's coming out of control. You look behind you, and on the other side of the footbridge are five people who are going to get hit by the trolley, but there's no switch, and there's no siding. There's no nothing. And so you think, well, the only way I could stop this trolley is if I dropped some very heavy object in front of it. And so you look around on the footbridge for a heavy object, and there isn't any heavy object. Except you're standing next to a fat guy. So now the question is, oh, do you still think that it's better to sacrifice one in exchange for five? Would you throw the fat guy off the bridge?
Thus the tagline of your book, would you throw the fat guy off the bridge? So let me ask you this, Thomas. The millions of people who tune in to watch this YouTube video and the mass appeal, does it say something about, you know, our morality now and maybe a new way that we're looking at it? Or is it that the way we've looked at our own morality has just been the same and so commonplace that we're getting philosophical?
Gee, that's a very good question. I'm not sure I know the answer, Lynn. I think that one difference today is that we are just subject to so much more information. You know, in the past, maybe the trolley problem would have been just as intriguing, but, you know, only the 50 people in a philosophy class and the You know, 30 people that read the journal article have even heard of it, and they pass it on by word of mouth, and maybe a couple more people get interested in it. Maybe some psychologist gets interested in it because he hears about it in an academic setting. But, you know, that process takes years and years and years. Now, instantly, these questions can be raised. And, you know, we're all familiar with the phenomenon of, you know, factual stories going viral. But this kind of puzzle can go viral like that, too. And so many more people just get caught up in it. I don't know if we think differently about these things or whether, you know, we have a different moral slant or whether we have more or less of an interest in moral issues. But, boy, just the fact that you can get involved in that kind of a discussion. There are chat rooms all over the place about the problem. It's now offered as parts of courses on campuses, but only because it first went crazy on the Internet.
Thomas, isn't there an issue here that humans are kind of inclined for the desire to be ethical? We want to do the right thing. We want to act morally and ethically. But when you get right down to it and you ask somebody to define what that means or even define what is good, you run into all sorts of vague notions and nobody really has a firm grasp or a critically thought out explanation. I mean, we all have a sense, but we can't really put words to it.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I do think that most people want to do the right thing. Almost all people, I think, probably want to do the right thing. We don't have a very good vocabulary for talking about it. And it's part of the appeal, I think, of the trolley problem is it does introduce, you know, some distinctions, like the two scenarios, that make you think about, well, you know, what kind of language would you use to explain what the dilemma is here? And, you know, what are some things that are and are not factors in it. So it makes you do that. I also agree with the other thing you said, and that is that I think most of us, because we don't have that vocabulary, react to ethical dilemmas sort of from our gut. And in fact, there's a website, actually, that allows you to take the trolley problem quiz. People afterwards are asked why they answered the way they did. I don't know if they are anymore, but for a long time they were asked why they thought the way they did. And most people said that some people came up with reasons, and they were different reasons. But some people said, I don't know. I just feel in my gut that there's a difference between the two things. One feels right to me and the other one doesn't. And as I say in the book, we don't have to be embarrassed about that because philosophers actually have a fancy name for that position. It's called ethical intuitionism. And it says that, you know, we make our moral decisions kind of intuitively, and then we go back and hang reasons on it. And I think to a large extent that's true. We do that. Because when people come up with reasons why they see a difference between the two scenarios, they come up with different reasons. Some people say it's because the act of pushing the man off the bridge is more personal. Which it obviously is. But some people say, no, that isn't it at all. The difference is that in the switch scenario, you don't really intend for that man to die, you know. The trolley is going to hit him, and that's an unfortunate consequence. But if he could somehow get out of the way, you hope he does. In the bridge scenario, you need the fat man to not get off the track. You need him to fall directly into the path of the trolley and get hit, because otherwise it doesn't save the five people. So that's another reason. But the bulk of people say, I don't know the reason. I just know it feels different to me.
And aren't there a number of thought problems or exercises that this also leads to? I mean, it depends on how we define or what we're trying to define in this example. What if the five people on the train are evil? And what if the one guy is Santa Claus and really good? And what if goodness, you know, the benefit to humanity is what you're trying to maximize, that utility? What if that's what you're trying to do? Then it leads you in a whole different direction from just a pure numbers.
Yeah, no, it sure does. Yeah. I think, in a sense, the trolley problem is kind of artificial because it assumes that you don't know anything and can't know anything about the people in the situation. Although that's also true in a lot of real life scenarios, like drone attacks and so forth. You don't know the people whose lives you are affecting, so you pretty much have to do it on the basis of the numbers, or not, or decide that it's wrong to do it. Those things make a huge difference in the psychological response anyway.
In your book, do you come to any sort of a conclusion, or do you pursue numerous paths and show that they really result in, you know, really critically thought out logical paths with no explanation?
Well, the conceit of the book is that it all takes place in a courtroom because somebody actually did pull the switch. And so now that person is being prosecuted. I don't think this would happen in real life, but in the book, being prosecuted for manslaughter. And so the conceit of the book is that you, the reader, are on the jury of the court of public opinion, and you have to decide. And so therefore, I don't come to a conclusion because I want the reader to wrestle with it and come to his or her own conclusion.
Thomas, you graduated from Harvard with a degree in philosophy, and you also studied theology. And so for someone like you, you delight in sitting around and pondering these things for hours and hours on end, I would imagine. To me, it sounds like either an exercise in futility or, you know, something that would lead me to great frustration. And and I do engage in these thoughts, and then I just think this is not productive.
Yeah. Well, that's a possible reaction. Yeah. I don't think the book is for everybody, or philosophy is for everybody, for that matter.
But
what I was moved by those 4.4 million people. I thought,
I know.
There's a lot of people out there besides me.
Exactly. And so, you know, it brings me to certain things that are somewhat similar. For example, you're driving along in the car, and on the side of the, you know, you're cruising along at 80 miles an hour, and on the side of the road, you see someone who is in apparent need of help, and your immediate thought goes to, oh, I'm out in the middle of nowhere. That's you know, it's a man. Maybe he's just staged his apparent need for help. I'm alone. I'm female. You know, all these things that run through your head in a split instant, and you either make a decision to stop or not.
Yep.
And then you are tormented for the next 20 miles about why you didn't stop, and what it means about all of humanity and our modern culture, and on and on and on. And so I don't know what my question here is, but, you know, maybe it all depends on the filter that we're looking, or our construct that we're looking at each question through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you made an excellent point. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and in particular, you know, when it's your own hide that's at stake. You know, if you're the guy tied to the track and you can reach the switch with your foot, that's a different question than if you're going to, pull the switch and eliminate some anonymous person.
So, Thomas, in your book, where the reader gets to draw their own conclusion, there obviously are no wrong conclusions.
Well, I don't know. Are there?
Well, everybody could come to their own personal conclusion based upon their own personal definition of basic terms, and if they critically followed that thought process to its logical conclusion, you could argue that that answer, regardless of what it is not invalid.
Yeah, I guess you could argue that, but you could also say that, there is a right answer, you're not going to come to it unless you ask some pretty probing questions. You may come to a different conclusion if you ask those questions, or you may just rationalize what your gut told you to begin with. That's probably the more likely scenario, actually. But in any case, I think the fact that everybody has to decide for themselves doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a better and worse answer.
So are they probing questions that need to be asked, or are they fully thought out definitions, or is it a combination of the two? Because how you define good and how you define utilitarianism is going to determine how you prioritize your decision making.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah. the people who think that it's only the consequences of your act that matter are the same people who say that, you know, it's better to that one person die than five die. But people who say, well, wait a minute, the minority has rights. The fat man has a right not to be pushed off of and to not be used as a way of saving five other people, well, against his will.
Especially if he's Santa Claus.
Especially if he's Santa Claus. Yeah, Santa Claus is fat enough. That qualifies him. Yeah.
There we go. So, Thomas, throughout your book, and by the way, your book is it's delightful. It's the type of book I can picture giving as a gift many, many, many times over. And what I love is you examine in these little side boxes, different philosophers throughout the ages, and they're people we've heard of before. And it you sort of give a background, a small biography, and then how they would sort of approach this problem.
Right.
But wanted to ask you about Niccolo Machiavelli.
Yeah.
And he's sort of towards the end of the book. And I never had heard the statement. I mean, I'm familiar with when people are labeled Machiavellian, but that he said the best way to handle people is to tell them what they want to hear.
That was actually used by the researchers as sort of a substitute for, or as a sort of a way to gain access to whether somebody was Machiavellian. You know, as I say in the book, I'm not sure that Machiavelli himself would have said that that was the best way to handle people is to tell them what they want to hear.
Right.
But that's the word he used. And so, and a lot of people, it turned out, the people who were willing to throw the fat man off the bridge were more likely to score on the Machiavellian side, as they defined it, and whether that definition is right or not, I don't know. But they were more likely. So apparently there were some psychological differences between people who were willing to sacrifice the fat man and people who were not willing.
Ah, very good. Oh, it's really quite something. Some philosophers I hadn't heard of before, but of course, let's talk about Nietzsche. And I don't know if I pronounce his last name. I've always had a problem with his last name and pronunciation. How do you say it?
I say it the way you say it.
Oh.
I say Nietzsche, yeah.
Okay. All right, there we go. Porsche,
I mean, I'll be right either, though. Don't quote me.
Okay. Okay, we'll talk about him and the Golden Rule and what he says about what it's done to our culture.
Oh, yeah. He says, and you know, there's some contemporary literature about this. Nietzsche wrote 150 years ago, but what he said was that, you know, this idea of turning the other cheek, he said, you know, really, that sort of Christian morality just sprang from resentment. The weak people had no way of fighting back when the strong people pushed them around, and because they couldn't fight back in that way, they picked a diabolical way. They labeled the strong people bad. And so they said, we, the weak people who turn the other cheek, are good, and you, the strong people who can push us around, you know, are bad. And so the way it comes sort of into play in the trolley problem is that if in the scenario where you're the one who gets run over because you're tied to the track, is it self-affirming in the way that Nietzsche meant self-affirming, to stand up for yourself and not allow the trolley to run over you? Isn't that the more natural thing to do? You know, isn't that the more you know, self-respecting thing to do? And so consequently, you turn on you know, Dr. Phil or somebody like that today, and you do hear a lot of sort of Nietzschean arguments. You know, women who for years and years and years were told to turn the other cheek just got a lot of sore cheeks. And so now, you know, it's part of our consciousness that people shouldn't allow themselves to be a doormat. Well, that's what Nietzsche was saying, too. Don't be a doormat. You know, he was, and I'm not sure he characterizes Christianity Christianity correctly as saying, be a doormat. I don't think that's what Christianity would say.
Right.
But that's what Nietzsche said. Nietzsche said, don't be a doormat. Don't be self-sacrificing. Stand up for yourself.
Wanted to ask you finally, did you have more fun writing this book or the New York Times bestseller Plato and a Platypus Walk Into a Bar?
You know, that's a good question. I had a different kind of fun. The Plato and the Platypus book, as you know, is about jokes that explain philosophy. And so it was just fun coming up with jokes. It was fun working with my co-author, Danny Klein, who's a real jokester and a really funny guy. The Trolley Problem, I had a different kind of fun. I was writing it by myself. And it was fun just trying to create kind of creative scenarios that would make it real, but that would make it kind of fun. So by setting it in the courtroom, and then later in the classroom, then later in a psychological publication, and then later in a faculty lounge. Just coming up with kind of creative ways to get these ideas out there was fun.
Very good. Well, the Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? It's a philosophical conundrum. And our guest is Thomas Cathcart. And Thomas, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. Thanks, Lynn. Thanks,
okay.
Tim.
Have fun.
Bye-bye.
And that again was Thomas Cathcart, difficult name to pronounce.
Especially when you want to say Carhartt.
Exactly. Right. And an interesting conversation with him. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back with Zach Frankel of the Utah Rivers Council right after this.
This is Zane Holmquist, executive chef from the Glitterton Restaurant at Stein Erickson Lodge, Deer Valley, a proud sponsor of KPCW. For 16 years, I've been creating fresh seasonal menus, highlighting locally sourced products, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week, and Jazz Sunday brunch. 645-6455 or steinlodge.com.
KPCW and TED are supported by Emerald Data Solutions, whose BoardDocs web applications help governing bodies operate more effectively here in Park City and throughout North America. BoardDocs services streamline processes used to create and manage board packets, access information, and conduct meetings. BoardDocs.com.
Travel Clean Car Wash is a proud sponsor of KPCW Radio. We use biodegradable detergents, recycled water, and solar power in our wash process. Travel Clean Car Wash is located next to McDonald's at Kimball Junction. Open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. TravelCleanCarWash.com, 647-WASH.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, water is critical to life in Utah, and yet Utah is the most wasteful water user in the country, with residents using nearly twice the per capita U.S. average. Some Utah cities use three times this average, and a whopping 70% of residential water use is used for overwatering lawns each summer. It's essential, yet going forward, if we don't conserve it at its extreme, Utah will no longer be a viable place to live. Joining us, that was the extreme, wasn't it? But it's true. And joining us now to talk about conservation practices and other issues related to water is Zach Frankel. He's the executive director of the Utah Rivers Council. And welcome to you, Zach.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Well, maybe we should just launch right into kind of a big picture question, which is, what's happening to our water in Utah? How finite is it?
That's an excellent question, Lynn. You know, water is really essential. We hear that all the time, and usually it's followed with some description of people drinking water or needing it for household use. What we often forget, though, is that water is essential to life outside of humans. Rivers in Utah provide habitat for 80% of the state's wildlife species for a portion of their life cycles. We are a dry state. We're the second driest state in the country, and that's exactly why our rivers are essential corridors of life for most species, fish, birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, you name it. They depend on the river corridor to exist, both in the water and, of course, because of the line of vegetation along the river. It's called a riparian zone. And it's a very diverse corridor of life. And what Utah is now faced with is a ridiculous number of proposed diversions across the state of Utah, very different than surrounding western states and how they're responding to growing populations. What we've got is hundreds of thousands of acre feet, which is a gigantic quantity of water, being proposed for diversion for municipal water use in Utah. Diversions on the Colorado, the Green, the Bear, the Price. All of these projects are being proposed for different human uses. And the argument, the dialogue, is framed around this idea that Utah is on the verge of crisis if these projects aren't approved. In reality, as you just described, we're one of the most wasteful water users in the entire United States. And most of that waste is a function of our economics and lack of real conservation progress.
Zach, can I ask you a question about that?
Please.
Are municipalities in Utah more rural by definition, and therefore per capita we're using more water than, say, more urban municipalities? Is that the core of the issue of our water use?
It's less about that. It's less about how it's accounted for, and it's more a function of just per-person water use.
Well, where does that come from? I mean, there must be a reason that people in Utah use 2 to 3 times more water per capita on average than the rest of the country.
Exactly.
And then I'm saying, well, we're more rural. We're using more for landscaping in an arid region.
So, and also drier. I mean, so we have to sprinkle and
yeah, if we want
water
anything
along.
Greener to have it grow. I mean, is that
you
where
know,
it's coming
that's
from?
That's a reasonable theory, but the simplest explanation and one that is clearly demonstrable when you look at the data, we have the cheapest water rates in the United States. We have ridiculously cheap water rates. Now, I want to say, as I say that, I'm talking about Utah as a whole. Park City has some of the most expensive water rates in all of Utah. And Park City has some of the most expensive water rates in many parts of the West.
Can you break that out and compare water rates in Park City not only to the West but also to these other areas that are consuming less per capita?
Yeah, so you can. The rate structures are a little bit complicated. It's easier to look at them graphically than it is to walk through all the data. But let me give you an example. Let me step outside of Park City for a moment, and then we can come back to it. So in St. George in Washington County is part of the community proposing the $1.5 billion Lake Powell Pipeline diversion of the Colorado River. So they're using 328 gallons per capita day. Okay, that's more than twice the national average, which is 155. Okay, they're paying $1.11 per 1,000 gallons. Okay, $1.11 per 1,000 gallons at actually their peak water use in July. So at 28,000 gallons, they're paying about $1.11 per 1,000 gallons. By comparison, the city of Seattle pays over $15 per 1,000 gallons. Okay, so here you have St. George, which is one of the driest communities in all of the United States, paying a ridiculously small amount for water. And you have Seattle, where so much water comes out of the sky, it's one of the wettest communities in the U.S., paying 15 times that price, right? What's going on there? That's nuts. Clearly, the cheap prices in Washington County account for why they're one of the biggest water wasters in the United States, and that's what you see. Now, Park City pays significantly more. The first benchmark that Park City pays is over $4 per 1,000 gallons, and then I believe it goes up to, 9 gallons per 1,000 gallons.
$9 per 1,000.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes,
from
$9.
From 4 to 9. Yeah.
$9.
You get the first 5,000 at a reduced rate, and then once you exceed that, you start to pay
a
higher rate.
Those tiering structures are good. Basically, the idea that the more you use, the more you pay per gallon, which makes sense so that that you're trying to encourage people to use less.
So is it that – okay, so you could make the argument that in Seattle, where they have an abundance of water that falls out of the sky, they still – realize that water is a critical resource and they value it as such. Park City, you could say, is kind of in the middle. We're working towards that. We're going to have higher water rates. That's a reality, although not many politicians will claim that that's going to happen, but that's definitely going to happen. It has to happen. And then you have St. George down in Washington County, and they don't treat it as a critical resource at all. Why is that?
That's an excellent question. So the reason these cheap water rates occur is actually because, this is totally ironic for Utah, property tax collections. Utah is unique in the American West in allowing the water suppliers here, the wholesale water suppliers called water conservancy districts, to collect property taxes, a levy on the value of everyone's home. So it's really ridiculous, but that's basically how these water rates are achieved. Back in St. George.
So you mean they're offsetting a user rate with a property tax?
So it's subsidized.
It's subsidized
exactly.
Through a property tax
collection. That's the magic word. It's subsidized. So it's really ridiculous because you can use very little water in your house. You could shut down your water and, you know, go to the Bahamas for a year. You're still paying property taxes for your neighbor to waste water or the school across the street or the park. Mm-hmm. So we're not using economics as a tool for water conservation. And water conservation, you know, there's no one panacea solution. It's a toolbox and you need to open it and have a variety of tools in there. Economics is one of the most important tools. And so collecting property taxes to encourage neighbors, to encourage people to waste water is ridiculous. And it's also unfair because low-income residents, people on smaller lots who are using less water, are still paying a property tax for large lot landowners to use water. So we think the property tax needs to be phased out. It's ironic that a conservative community of Utah collects this property tax, this communist idea that we should be encouraging people to use this commodity.
So other than the user, who benefits? Did the water companies benefit from that hugely?
Immensely. And it's totally nonsense. If you think about other commodities, it wouldn't make sense to give Questar or Rocky Mountain Power or Quest a property tax to pay their commodities. They figure out how to do it in the rate structures. And yet with water suppliers, they say, oh, well, we need the stability. It's just nuts. They don't need the stability. What we find is we find residents paying property taxes that don't receive any water from the water supplier themselves. We find the property tax being over-collected when auditors have come in to audit the agencies. We find all kinds of abuse with the property tax. It doesn't make any sense. It'd be one thing if this was a hard user system to create, you know, a fee for, like a highway. It's hard to make people pay for highway use because what if I don't use the highway? Water's not that way. Water's very, very simple. I use it, I should pay for it.
Their customers will never go away.
Exactly.
Really. So has this come before the legislature, or is this too much of a too much with the powers that be that
vested interest.
Yeah.
So we've taken this legislature. I wrote the last bill that we took. Senator John Valentine brought to the Senate floor. And we barely got it through committee, and then it got
watered down. Do they understand what you're talking about?
Yeah, they do and they don't. There's some great legislators that do. You know, water is a complicated subject. Anybody that gets into the subject of water realizes how complicated it is. And so what you have is a new crop of legislators coming in every few years and water suppliers literally creating this ridiculous dialogue that, oh, if the property tax is phased out, we're literally going to run out of water.
Well, they're doing their own lobbying. Do they have
exactly
professional lobbyists
working
for them as well?
Oh, yeah. There's scores and scores of them. In fact, if you look at the lobbying interests in the lobby forum, it's amazing.
So there's if you follow the money, there's a huge vested interest in the current system and the status quo, which benefits these water conservancy districts. And, you know, that's the fight you're going to be up against. And then they're using their lobbyists to educate the new legislators that come in. And that's an uphill battle.
Exactly.
It's the same. I mean, right here in Utah, we're looking at what we see nationally. So,
yeah.
Okay. Have a nice day, everyone.
I would even describe
your moment of zen.
Yeah. I would describe it that they're using our property tax collections to pay lobbyists to fight phasing out property taxes. It's ironic.
Wanted to ask you a question back to economics. We live in an affluent community here. Do economics really come into play at all? Because, you know, last week at the Project for Deeper Understanding, there were some questions posed by the audience about water. And, you know, some of the panelists said, well, it's all about economics. The more expensive it gets, the more people will conserve. I think that is a flawed argument because in this community, it's a badge of honor to consume among a certain demographic, shall we say. There's no need to conserve if the price on your water bill.
If I can pay for it,
why conserve?
Well, there certainly is an ethic about water use, and it splits both ways. Some people, I mean, stop me on the street, and they literally take me aside and apologize for having a lawn. And, you know, I'm suddenly supposed to relieve their guilt because they have grass, right? And then other people, you know, sweat over a small, you know, couple of square inches of dry grass, yellow grass on an otherwise green lawn. And, you know, they apologize for having a yellow lawn. So you see the full spectrum. I think economics is not the panacea, but I think it's an important solution. I think, you know, Park City's done a good job by implementing a rate structure that does make some sense. Whether or not it's going to solve all our problems, clearly not. But I do think it's an important step. I mean, Park City is many steps ahead of places like St. George, which is actively encouraging waste,
right,
in the economics. What the problem we see in Utah is that we see a tremendous amount of lip service to water conservation. What we see is the Slow the Flow campaign. So the Slow the Flow campaign, let me give you an idea of the state's priorities. The state has spent $25 million.
Oh, boy. I don't think I'm going to like this.
To prepare the EIS for the proposed Colorado River diversion, the Lake Powell pipeline. Okay. The Slow the Flow campaign costs about $250,000 a year. So you got to ask, which is more important to the state, telling people to conserve water or working on diverting rivers? When we go to the state house, the same architects tell us, oh, well, we can't really save much more water through water conservation. In fact, the director of the state water agency, the Division of Water Resources, has coined his own law named after himself called Strong's Law. And it says that if water is conserved, something has to die. So that's the leader on water conservation in the state of Utah telling people that if you save water, something will die. So that's a really bad ethic. So what we see is this top-down opposition to reducing water waste. And so it's not surprising that you see these big, gigantic, expensive water projects being proposed as the only solution. Mm. And you know what's hilarious about it? When you start talking about water, you know, people's natural reaction is to assume we're talking about needs. We're talking about, you know, people literally shriveling up into prunes in the desert sun. What we're really talking about is grass. We're talking about watering grass, and we're talking about watering pavements, sidewalks, driveways. We're not really talking about needs. We're talking about waste, and we're talking about use. So our whole point is just let's start by eliminating the waste. Let's address needs. Let's address use afterwards. First of all, let's just eliminate the waste. But we have a lot of resistance to that. As you just articulated, Tim, there's special interests that really want billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar contracts to build these mm-hmm. projects.
I feel the time slipping away here, Zach. We could go on talking to you all morning.
We're going to need to do that at some point.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get into water storage. As we know, snow is the way to store our water. 80% of the water coming down into the Wasatch Front, anyway, is from snow melt. So let's talk a little bit about where that goes. And then, you know, people are concerned here about this way out in the future proposed Round Valley Reservoir.
Yeah, there's a number of large infrastructure projects being proposed in Utah. Round Valley is one of the ones that's being discussed. There's an agreement signed by various agencies in this basin to look at new water storage options. The issue is that people need to understand that supply equals demand. And so you don't want to just focus on supply solutions. You want to focus on demand solutions like we just talked about. The Weber Basin Water District is taking the lead now on the Round Valley Reservoir. So that's kind of an unheard of water district in this county, which is ironic because every resident in Summit County is paying a property tax to this agency. Weber Basin Water District delivers both irrigation and municipal water. And one of the biggest projects they've got going on, actually, that listeners might be interested in is the proposed Bear River diversion. Mm-hmm. So just a few months ago, they showed up at the legislature and said, we need to start raising money from taxpayers to build that $2 billion diversion of the Bear. The Bear is the single largest water source entering the Great Salt Lake. It provides 60% of the surface water to the Great Salt Lake every single year. If the Bear is diverted, it would lower the Great Salt Lake 2 to 4 feet in elevation, and doing that would dry up hundreds, well, tens of thousands of acres of shoreline wetlands around the perimeter of the lake. So there's big projects on the horizon, lots of future discussion needed about whether these projects are necessary. You know, what's interesting about Weber Basin is that, you know, Park City's looking at the water up here and how water use is used up here, but it all flows downstream. If we can lower demand downstream in the lower basin, it reduces demand on the upper basin water users. So those are some of the things to be thinking about in the coming months and years.
Okay, Zach Frankel, unfortunately we're out of time, but Zach is the executive director of the Utah Rivers Council. And where can people go to? I mean, it's about educating ourselves. That's our job as users of water.
Yeah, so our website has a ton of information, videos, information research. It's utahrivers.org, really easy to find. That's the we have a bunch of links and destinations from there that people can educate themselves.
Great. Zach, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And want to thank also Rick Ernst from the Park City Community Church and Thomas Cathcart, and also thank our underwriters.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Park City Clinic, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park Meadows Country Club, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate, and finally Grand Valley Bank.
And you've been listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with Tim Henney, and time now for National Public Radio News. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Good morning.